Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With plastic surgery come some familiar stories. The classmate who goes on an extended vacation to fix a deviated septum. The aging friend who comes back from a long break with a perpetually surprised expression. The B-list celebrity with the swollen lips. Or in the extreme cases, the overzealous surgeries making a person virtually unrecognizable. Think Michael Jackson. As shocking as the results of a procedure may be, an estimate from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons is truly startling. Between 2005 and 2013, the number of cosmetic procedures performed on Asian Americans increased by 125%, Hispanics by 85%, and African Americans by 56%, while for Caucasians, the number increased just 35%. Maureen O'Connor wrote about the rise in an article for New York Magazine called "Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield." Maureen's a writer for New York Magazine. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with those numbers that you cite in the article. What accounts for the dramatic and rapid rise in cosmetic procedures among the Asian Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics, especially in recent years?
Well, to some degree, it's probably sort of a catch-up process in that as minorities have, you know, bigger purchasing power, they have more ability to have luxury goods, and plastic surgery is essentially a luxury good in America. On top of that, there is sort of this huge boom in surgery, particularly overseas in Asia, and to some degree, some of the surgeries now occurring stateside are sort of mimicking or following that pattern, too.
What are some of the most commonly performed procedures or requested?
One of the big growth areas has been Asian blepharoplasty, which is the Asian double eyelid surgery, which is when some portion of Asians, not all, have what's called a monolid, which is when the skin on the eye goes straight, basically in one plane from the brow to the lash line with no crease. So adding a crease or enlarging a very small crease is a procedure that is pretty much specific and unique to Asians because they are, for the most part, the people that have that type of eye. It's like getting an eye lift, but a little bit different and a little specific to the anatomy of the Asian eye to create that crease.
What are some of the other common procedures?
So under this term, ethnic plastic surgery, which has turned into sort of a surgical term of art now, that also includes things like what is known as an ethnic rhinoplasty, which whereas a traditional rhinoplasty on a Caucasian person will usually be a reduction, pulling down sort of a prominent nose or a hump in a nose by shaving it down or removing some. An ethnic rhinoplasty usually involves the insertion of an implant, which, and you'll see that on, for instance, like Asian people, sometimes African Americans or Latinos at a very low line, the bridge of their nose. And so a surgeon will raise the bridge and perhaps refine the tip, too.
So the sort of sculpted, more Michael Jackson-y look in the later years.
Well, I think that people are trying not to get the Michael Jackson look in particular anymore. But that is, I mean, that's sort of the rough, that's sort of what people associate with it, particularly people that haven't had or don't have familiarity with these surgeries. There's a very sort of negative stigma, in part because of people like Michael Jackson that have had very sort of notorious mess-ups and notorious sort of confusions that end up being racially charged when people look at them saying, are you trying to erase your ethnicity or change it?
But broadly, these procedures do make people look less ethnic, quote unquote, and that's actually the terminology that some of the plastic surgeons you spoke with, you know, they're kind of whiteifying features. And you spoke to some of the patients about their motivations. And what did you learn?
Well, you know, when I went into it, and particularly because they use that term ethnic plastic surgery, the assumption is that they're trying to remove some level of ethnicity. But 201, absolutely nobody said they wanted to look white. Everybody was sort of talking about modifying their features sort of incrementally, or they want to look like who they actually are, but with something changed. And so it's hard to ignore the fact that, for instance, you're changing this feature that is sort of endemic to Asians, say a monolid, and to say that must have to do with a white ideal. But on the other hand, there are plenty of surgeries that fall under this ethnic plastic surgery umbrella that actually have no Caucasian corollary or no Caucasian ideal connected to it, which, for instance, there's also a trend among the Asian American community of facial contouring, which would be a woman who takes, say, prominent cheekbones and pulls them in and softens them, or gets V-line surgery on her chin to sort of make this sort of small, dainty chin. And those are two things that actually fall under that umbrella and don't have a Caucasian corollary. So as I worked on this, my question sort of started to be, why are we so focused on these things that we can say, oh, that's westernizing? Why are we not willing to take these people at their word when they say it's not about looking white?
Mm. We're talking with Maureen O'Connor, who's a writer for New York Magazine, about the plasticity of race. There's been a huge increase in plastic surgeries among people of Asian American, Hispanic American, and African American descent, people who are changing their features to become, quote unquote, less ethnic or more Western. Or is it that? As we're learning from Maureen, it's a lot more complicated. So calling it ethnic plastic surgery may be an oversimplification or worse, mm-hmm. or a completely racist assumption.
It is, and it's sort of one thing that shocked me as I was working on this was that we're so used to sort of this, in an age of political correctness, to hear somebody say, oh, well, that's a Caucasian feature, that one's very nice, or this is an Asian feature, I would give you plastic surgery on it, is almost blasphemous to the ear of somebody who's so used to extraordinary carefulness when we talk about race. And even that term ethnic plastic surgery sort of defies the common definition of ethnicity, which usually has to do with language and culture, and race, which usually has to includes physical appearance. Mm. And so there's sort of this sort of brashness to the way that people go forward with this, which is at one hand very shocking, but on the other hand a little bit freeing as well.
Let's hear an example here from September of last year. The TV personality Julie Chen, she's one of the hosts of this show, The Talk. She revealed that she had undergone blepharoplasty on the show. Now, here she is explaining how it came about, a conversation with her agent.
And I want to show you a side-by-side of how dramatic this surgery really was. I mean, if you look at the after, the eyes are bigger. Mm-hmm. I look more alert.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More expressive.
Right. And but how do you feel about yourself right now?
Now it's like I sometimes wonder. But I will say after I had that done, everything kind of the ball did roll for me. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I struggle with, wow. You know, did I give in to the man and do this? Yeah. And it was...
Sorry, you didn't give in to the man, Julie. You know, because you don't know about giving in to the man. You
know? Fair enough. Right. I will say this.
Right. You didn't do that. You made a choice that was good for you. You have represented, I'm going to say it, your people. You represented your race. You represented women and your colleagues. Don't look back.
Thank you.
So her co-host says, you know, you didn't give in to the man. But what was the response from the public, especially among Asian Americans?
You know, that just hearing that now, you notice the marked difference between the way the audience is reacting with gasp,
yes.
sort of shock,
uh-huh.
and then the way, you know, Sharon Osbourne saying, fabulous, as though she's discovered some, like, beautiful new shade of eyeshadow. The public... There was a lot more gasping in the public audience than there was among her co-hosts. We'll put it that way, that I think a lot of people... saw that, and particularly because she told that story in the context of, I had a boss who said I couldn't be a news anchor because I looked too Chinese. I had an agent who told me he wouldn't take me on. She put it in sort of the world of racism, and I think that is the way a lot of people end up feeling and seeing these procedures. So a lot of people did say, yeah, you gave in to the man. You just said this is the man, a TV honcho who tells you to get surgery, and you did it. On the other hand, she then did a follow-up where she said, I wasn't trying to erase my race. I don't think that's what this procedure does. Which sort of demonstrates the sort of ambivalence that I think a lot of people have.
And a lot of the outrage on these westernizing elements of plastic surgery actually do come from white people. You know, these are the people who say, how could you possibly cave in to an agent who would say something like that? So are we putting too much of the onus for this on other ethnic groups?
You know, it is interesting that as I was working on this, all of a sudden I wondered why there's such a vested interest in policing what minorities do to body parts that we associate with their race, and to sort of feel like we need to police that an Asian person, these eyes we think make them look Asian, and thus they're not allowed to change them. And then I started wondering, where does that impulse come from? Why does that all of a sudden become everybody else's business because it's a body part that we associate with racial identity?
You yourself, Maureen, consulted a very famous plastic surgeon, you know, when you were working on this article.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are criticizing doctors who profit off of these procedures. Mm-hmm. Have these surgeries that are popular in other countries been more widely adopted by doctors in the U.S. in recent years?
They're certainly booming, definitely, here. One thing that one doctor pointed out to me was she said, well, when you look at the photos of and the types of surgeries people get, say, in Korea versus the things that Korean Americans or Asian Americans get, it's much more extreme overseas. And to some degree, that's probably because the medical laws and practices are just more loose out there. To another degree, though, what she suggested was she said, well, maybe it's that over here, an Asian person would see all the variety of all different peoples of different races every day, and you get used to sort of thinking that you're altering your face to fit in among a very diverse crowd. And then some of that is the sort of shocking frankness of people who choose to look at beauty and faces as something that can be chosen from among the features of all the peoples in the world. And there's something sort of almost comfortingly, almost post-racial about it in some strange way, to be totally sort of freed from all of the baggage associated with that and to just say, well, these are the features that you want to change. I'm going to change them for you without any bringing in the political implications every single time.
Well, you think, you know, you could say, I want Jessica Alba's nose or Kim Kardashian's bottom, you know. There is this kind of commodification about it that still feels a little creepy, you know, that you can just build yourself or even breed a child to look a particular way.
It's very, it felt very much like science fiction sometimes, although the question is this a dystopia or a utopia? It's sort of alarming in many ways to hear people talking about race and ethnicity with such sort of freeness, as though you can sort of pick and choose pieces of it.
Maureen O'Connor, I want to thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maureen O'Connor is a writer for New York Magazine, and you'll find a link to read her article, Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Cosmetic surgery may be problematic for race and identity, but it's like gravy when it comes to good material for jokes. From Kathy Griffin to Chris Rock, comedians routinely poke fun at those who get work done, or in the case of Joan Rivers, poke fun at themselves. Here is a short collection of stand-up comics taking on plastic surgery.
I would never get plastic surgery, clearly. But I don't understand it. I don't, especially when it becomes recreational and repetitive. Women do it all the time to look younger. And it would make perfect sense if one of them ever came out looking younger. Men get it too, not as much, but they do. I read a story about one guy that got a lot of plastic surgery and he's in his late 70s. Getting plastic surgery in your late 70s, it's kind of like painting your house as the fire approaches.
Michael Jackson going to jail. It's gonna be a sad sight when Michael Jackson goes to jail. Oh, we gonna shed a tear when Michael Jackson go to jail. And it ain't even gonna be sad the day he go in. It's gonna be sad like a month later when that perm grows out of his hair. So he don't got the Crayola people to fix his face no more.
Okay, now can we talk about
Heidi Montag?
Oh my gosh.
Go.
All right. First of all, it should be on the Discovery Channel because she is the first human to have a successful entire head transplant. Entire head transplant. This isn't dental work.
Dude, if you're thinking about getting a facelift, do yourself a favor. Just wait it out. Let them practice on other people's faces. When they work it out, then you go in. It's like hair plugs. Hair plugs don't look half bad, no. Saw a guy in a commercial the other night. He's like, ah, God, I wish I did this 10 years ago. It's like, no, you don't. 10 years ago, when they were stapling ant legs to the top of people's heads, everybody's eyes watering, trying not to look at your hairline. Dude, you got to be happy with who you are, man. There's nothing wrong with being 45 and looking 45. Would you rather be 45 and look 45 or be 45 and look like a 28-year-old lizard? Yeah, that's basically your options.
Comedians Kathy Griffin, Bill Burr, Chris Rock, and Dana Gould there, making hay out of the pitfalls of plastic surgery. Up next, we're going to head to Kabul, Afghanistan, to find out why more and more women there are considering plastic surgery. That's when Word of Mouth returns with its all-natural self after the break. We'll be right back. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In Afghanistan, a man and a woman may meet each other for the first time at the marriage altar. If the groom pulls back the veil and does not like what he sees, he can send the woman, shamed and forever tainted, back to her family. To avoid such a fate, women in the capital are increasingly considering plastic surgery. Reporter Gregory Warner followed one such woman into the surgeon's office to investigate.
Since she was 12, Benafshah was sure that if not for the shape of her nose, she'd be beautiful.
Mostly it was my sister that would mention it. When we got in an argument, she'd say, "Your nose is like the fist of a cat."
Benafshah is Hazara, the Asian-featured ethnic minority. In Afghanistan, the beauty standard is Persian or Indian. Straight noses are preferred.
Girls have to be beautiful for marriage. They can't have noses that are too flat.
As an Afghan woman, making a good marriage was pretty much her only option for having a decent life. When mothers of prospective suitors came to visit, they always scrutinized her nose. So the winter she turned 19, Benafshah collected $60 she'd saved, plus another $200 from her uncle, and took it all to a crumbling building in downtown Kabul. To a clinic, smelling faintly of formaldehyde.
This is the new operation room?
Yes.
Dr. Hamkar is the lead surgeon of Afghanistan's first and only plastic surgery clinic.
It's very primitive.
It is very primitive.
Primitive operation. The lamp is not...
A big green lamp from the Soviet era illuminates the operating table, while a row of kitchen cabinets are jammed with gauze and scalpels. The TV stuck in the corner plays that most psychedelic of American cartoon shows, Teletubbies.
This is something new.
That's Hamkar's assistant, Dr. Daoud.
In Afghanistan, especially recently, this year, we see some patients who come to have, for example, for mammoplasty.
That means breast?
Breast, yeah, to have a smaller breast.
Daoud blames Afghan television. Afghans went from no TV under the Taliban to a flood of movies and even fashion and style shows today.
It made the people to care about their physical condition, about, yeah. They say that I'll show you a picture of, for example, actress, Indian actress. They say, I don't know, look like this. But they think that it's possible to change their face at all.
They want a whole new face.
Yeah, because of some movies, I think, they've watched on TV, for example, American or Indian movies. They think that it's possible.
But Daoud says that most of the clients in his clinic don't come pursuing a fantasy. They just want a normal life.
For example, girls who have some problem on their face, and this is the reason why they cannot get married. There was a girl, she had some hairs, you know, on her face. And she was engaged. Her fiancé didn't know about the beard that girl had, you know.
Her future husband had only ever seen her in a burqa.
She said if he knows about it, she'll be divorced and it will be something very bad for her.
So she hawked her engagement ring, paid Daoud for the treatment, and by the time the burqa came off on her wedding day...
When her husband lifted off her veil for the first time and he looked at her face... Do you think he could tell that she had had surgery, or he?
No.
You think he just thought, this is my beautiful wife?
I don't think so. Yeah.
It's afternoon when Benafshah, the first girl we met, comes in for her checkup. She's wearing a colored headscarf and pink nail polish, and proudly sports a cardboard cast over her nose. It's been 9 days since her nose job.
Actually, can you do me a favor? Can we look at the photo together? Sure. Is it okay?
I asked Daoud to call up the before photo on the computer, the original nose that her sister called a cat's fist. And as they do it, I can't help but notice that Benafshah blushes. When the doctors do show her the photo of her old nose, you can hear her voice is diminished, like she's lost her confidence. There's that old debate about cosmetic surgery. Is it a form of self-expression, or is it social pressure? Of course, it's both. We get the freedom to change ourselves, and we use it to look like everybody else. In Afghanistan, too, they're mixed together. The freedom to uncover, and the freedom to conceal.
And that story was produced by BendingBorders.org. It's part of the Global Story Project with support from the Open Society Foundation and presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Up next, we're going to take a look at the little understood organ that got us all here, the mysteries of the placenta, when Word of Mouth returns after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, the placenta is the least understood human organ, and arguably one of the most important. Weighing in around a pound, this veiny blue magenta blob plays the role of several major organs while a fetus is in utero, including liver, lungs, and kidney. Yet despite being a complete package life support system, it remains high on the gross-out factor scale. So high, in fact, that some people don't even want to discuss it. Well, not the team at Word of Mouth. We cruise the halls of NHPR and ask parents for their firsthand experiences with the body's most mysterious organ.
So when I was in high school, I heard this really amazing midwife talk about how magical the placenta was. And it wasn't until the day after I had given birth to my son that I realized that I had never seen it and that the doctor never showed it to me. So I was extremely traumatized that I never got to see my placenta, and have always imagined it to be some sort of kind of mythical, amazing glob. I feel disappointed that I never got to just see what it looked like.
No, I have no interest in seeing anything that comes from within me. I feel like it's in me for a reason, and only the baby is the exception to that. It comes out and you see it and you rejoice, and even then they clean it off and nobody says, oh my gosh, that's such a cute baby when it comes out of you. No one's going to say that about a placenta either.
Before you have a baby, they show you this video and they're like, what most people don't realize is that they first push out their baby, but then there's more pushing after, and it's going to be your placenta. I actually did remember that. So after I had my first son, I remember thinking, wow, I really got to like go for it and push it out. So I pushed it out and it came flying out. It was a little bit disturbing. And I asked them to immediately take it away.
I don't remember when we first decided that we were going to make placenta prints, but I was in charge of sort of getting that ready. That was like one of my jobs.
What's a placenta print?
Okay, so...
Maybe we should start there.
I don't know if a lot of people do it, but enough people do it that it's a thing. Where after the placenta is birthed, you take it and you roll ink over the side of it that's really veiny. It's the side that the umbilical cord comes out of. You would roll ink or paint over it, and you would press it against a piece of paper or a canvas. And because of the veins, it kind of looks like a tree.
Well, I'd had some friends tell me that they'd used their placenta for postpartum supplements. Some had used it in their gardens for, I don't know, but I really wasn't interested in it. I didn't ask to see it, but my doctor showed it to me and asked me if I wanted, and I said, I'm good, thanks. It was gross.
The crazy thing is I don't remember my son being born as well as I remember making the placenta print. I have like snapshots of the birth, but it was so emotional and it was, you know, your endorphins are just going crazy. But like 20 minutes later, after the action sort of calmed down a little bit, then I am holding this gooey purple red organ in my hands and thinking, okay, what am I doing now? I can't even describe what it was like to roll the ink onto it because it's so squishy. I don't know. It's just so hard to describe. It is the single weirdest experience of my life.
And so what did you do with the print? Were you happy with how it came out?
Oh, yeah. Actually, the prints came out great. I gave one to my dad, and he still has that framed, like, above his stairs. You would never know how, like, kind of gross the organ itself is from the print because the prints are beautiful.
So, many accounts. Beautiful, vital, and mysterious. Dr. Susan Fisher, a professor of obstetric gynecology and reproductive sciences, and other researchers are aiming to demystify the placenta. The New York Times reporter Denise Grady wrote about these ongoing efforts and joins us now with more. Denise, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
It's funny. The placenta is so mysterious to us, given that it is actually one of the few organs that we can actually observe and even hold outside of the body. What gives?
And when you think about it, it also is an organ that fully forms in this very short time period during a pregnancy, and then we throw it away. So it's unique in that sense, and we don't think about it all that much. But it turns out that there's a whole kind of world of researchers out there who are studying it for a whole variety of reasons. It turns out to have a lot more impact on the pregnancy and even health later in life than people had realized before.
So when does the placenta actually start to grow within the human body?
As soon as the fertilized egg implants in the uterus, and that's usually about a week after it's fertilized, as soon as it touches down, the placenta begins forming. It comes entirely from the embryo. It's not a tissue that grows from the mother or the uterus. It actually is all fetal. And the fertilized egg, if you can imagine, it has this outer layer of cells, and those are what wind up becoming the placenta. And as soon as it touches down and starts to implant in the uterus, those cells kind of, they invade. When you hear researchers talking about the placenta, they talk all the time about the human placenta being very invasive, which sounds kind of creepy, but it is.
And it leads to the question of, who does the placenta actually belong to? Is it the mother's organ or is it belong to the fetus?
It's a great question because it is, genetically, it is entirely a fetal tissue. And yet it manages to bridge between the two of them. It does what the fetus needs. It takes from the mother, but it doesn't take so much that it will harm her because you need her to be healthy for the pregnancy to survive. And it manages also to sort of hide from the immune system and not be rejected, even though it's really not the mother's tissue. As I say, it has the same makeup as the baby.
What is a healthy placenta actually doing in the body?
The first thing that it does and spends a lot of time doing in the first couple of months of pregnancy is embedding itself in the wall of the mother's uterus and going into her blood vessels and actually sending in these placental cells that actually kind of replace the lining of some of the mother's own arteries. And it expands those arteries so that they are dumping blood into the placenta, where it can then take out oxygen and nutrients that the fetus needs and also use that bridge between the two blood supplies. They don't touch each other, but they are bridged by the placenta to get rid of wastes from the fetus.
What happens then when a placenta does not develop correctly or there are problems within it?
The researchers are thinking now that a lot of miscarriages and maybe miscarriages even that happened so early that a woman might not even have known she was pregnant, as well as some later ones, used to be thought, well, there must be something wrong with the fetus. But there's a more of a recognition now that some of those problems may come from a placenta that, for reasons are really not always understood, doesn't form properly. If that invasion that we're talking about and the growth of the placenta and capturing that blood supply, if that doesn't happen properly, you may reach a point where it cannot support the pregnancy and you can lose the pregnancy, or you can have a premature birth or a very low birth weight baby, or you can have this condition that can be very dangerous in pregnancy called preeclampsia, where the mother's blood pressure goes up and she has a lot of other problems that can be life-threatening to both her and the baby. And the only cure for that is to deliver the baby and get the baby and the placenta out of there.
After the child is delivered, however, that's the big feat, and then comes the placenta. In a typical hospital setting, what happens to the placenta after it's birthed?
In a lot of hospitals, somebody might just give it a quick look, and it probably winds up going out with the medical waste or into the incinerator. But in some hospitals, first, if there's any problem with the pregnancy, it can be sent to a pathologist who specializes just in looking at placentas to try to get some clues about what might have gone wrong with the pregnancy. And in those hospitals, they will have all of the placentas from every pregnancy saved in a refrigerator for a week or two until they're sure that there is no problem, and they will not be discarded before that. And then you have places like the University of California at San Francisco, which I wrote about, where they actually have a recruiter who goes to women in labor and asks if they will donate their placentas for research. And if they do give them up, they are rushed into the lab and taken apart, and all sorts of preparations are made with different pieces of cells and tissue, and the researchers there study them, and they also are a nationwide bank, and they send them out to all kinds of other researchers who ask for them to do various kinds of studies on them and try to figure out how they work.
Denise Grady, reporter with the New York Times, wrote about what may be one of the least understood human organs, and that's the placenta. The aftercare at the hospital is one thing, but a lot of people have written about the myriad traditions and the nutritional fads associated with the placenta. Some do advocate for eating it, others bury it, some use it to make art. Why do you think the placenta has this almost mystical reputation?
I'm thinking that in some of the earlier traditions, I think people must have been very impressed and kind of mystified by it, because it is huge and it's kind of awful looking in a way. It's a big bloody organ with a lot of blood vessels and on it. So I think people wondered what on earth it was. And in some cases, I think there were some cultures where they actually thought that it might have been a lost sibling. And others thought it had some kind of spiritual manifestations of the soul or a spirit. And so you needed to treat it properly so that the child would be okay later in life.
Of course, the element of eating the placenta has caught a lot of people's imagination. Has any science been done to back up those who advocate for eating the placenta after delivery, saying that it's good for recovery?
There is really not much known about whether it's a good idea. There's been a little research, but nothing that seems solid. But people do want to eat it. There are some people who cook it. There are people who put it into smoothies. And there are also places that will dry it out and then pack it into pills so that women can take it kind of like medicine.
Well, considering it as medicine, Denise, you mentioned those who study the placenta after birth looking for trouble. What could it actually be used for? What can it indicate? How can it help if there were signs of trouble in a young child or the mother?
Both of the pathologists mentioned cases where there's a stillbirth or a miscarriage, and it's very hard to figure out what's going on. And sometimes you can get clues about it from the placenta, and it can be a great deal of sort of comfort to the family, at least to have an explanation. People apparently are just overwhelmed with guilt in addition and to their grief over this. And one of the doctors said that you could almost see the weight coming off their shoulders when they were given some explanation and could understand that what happened was maybe a bad stroke of luck biologically or genetically and not their fault, not something they had done wrong.
Denise, what is the next step in exploring and understanding this strangely invasive, mysterious, yet essential organ, the placenta?
Well, the National Institutes of Health is trying to start a human placenta project. They want to unite researchers all over the world in learning more about the placenta, how it forms, and what can go wrong. And the ultimate goal, which may sound very ambitious, but what they hope ultimately is to understand it better so that they can predict when a pregnancy is heading for trouble and maybe even in the long term find ways to treat these problems in pregnancy, maybe even, you know, prevent something like preeclampsia. Or at the very least, if you have some idea that something may be going wrong with the placenta, at least you can try to be prepared to deal with it rather than being ambushed and taken by surprise. So the long-range goal are to try to help women and make pregnancies healthier for people who have been having problems.
New York Times reporter Denise Grady, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It was delightful to talk to you.
You can find a link to Denise's article on the placenta, including a short film, at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With a new month comes a new crop of music, handpicked by producer Zach Nugent. Here's Zach with August's Audio Orchard playlist.
Well, we're into August now, so for this month's Audio Orchard, I chose songs that evoke the dog days of summer. Songs with a little bit of a country twang, something you might listen to as the summer evenings are starting to get a little darker and a little cooler. The first song on the playlist is called Dearly Departed by Shaky Graves, featuring Esme Patterson.
Well, you and I both know that the house is haunted. Well, you and I both know that the ghost is on me. You should catch me in your bed, she's just rattling your chain. Well, back then, baby, it didn't seem so strange.
Shaky Graves is the moniker of Alejandro Rose Garcia from Austin, Texas. He's probably more known for bit parts in movies and TV shows like Friday Night Lights and Spy Kids 3D. In between auditions and acting jobs, he would play small gigs around the Southwest. His music has started to take off in a way his acting never did, and now he's a full-time musician. His sophomore album, And the War Came, comes out this fall. You can go to NHPR.org to see a video of Shaky and Esme's performance of the song. And I must say, there is some intense chemistry between the two.
Well, back then, baby, it didn't seem so strange. In the midnight hour, you came alive.
I was looking for my crystal ball.
I was busy trying to farm that snake.
When the sun came up, we had no place to hide.
And you had to tell your friends that my fangs were fake.
I just had to. Oh.
The next song on the playlist is called Katie Queen of Tennessee. It's by the band Apache Relay. Apache Relay formed in the dorms of Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. They've been playing the folk rock circuit for a few years now, with bands like Mumford & Sons. Katie Queen of Tennessee is their attempt to break away from the folk rock genre and dive into something a little different. The added strings and harmonies give this song a Phil Spector, Wall of Sound feel. The band is currently on tour opening for Jenny Lewis. The next song on the playlist is Don't Tell Your Friends About Me by Blake Mills.
The older I am, the wiser I'm known. I felt ashamed of how angry I'm gone. Although I was not getting my message across, I know you can't stand me. How I talk when I summon a duel with that brain that you thought I was wrong to notice it against you. Sure, some of them could use a good talk, but babe, don't tell all our friends about me. Please, babe, don't tell our friends about me.
Blake Mills is usually a behind-the-scenes guy, working for bands like Haim and the Avett Brothers. He most frequently collaborates with Fiona Apple, and she repays the favor here, singing backing vocals on this folk tune. His second solo album, Hi Ho, will be out this fall.
So please, baby, don't tell all our friends about me. Please, baby, don't tell all our friends about me.
The next song in the playlist probably goes in the guilty pleasure category. Even though I don't feel guilty about it, I know I should. The song is called Geronimo by the band Shepherd.
Can you feel it? Now it's coming back. We can steal it. If we bridge this gap, I can see you through the curtains of the waterfall.
Shepherd is a family band from Australia. Their sugary sweet pop music has taken the country by storm, and this song, Geronimo, has become the song of the summer. Their debut album, Bombs Away, is out now, and I promise not to judge if you want to take a listen.
And you can find Zach's full playlist at wordofmouthradio.org. And what about you? Do you have a new song that you just can't stop listening to? We'd love to hear it. Post a link to your new favorite music on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And help us create a community-sourced playlist.
We rushed it, moving way too fast, and we crushed it, but it's in the past. We can make this link.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the body's most mysterious and perhaps grossest organ, the placenta.
So I was extremely traumatized that I never got to see my placenta and have always imagined it to be some sort of kind of mythical, amazing glob.
We were surprised at how many people had placenta stories, so we would love to hear yours in 140 characters. Yes, you heard me correctly. We want your placenta story on our Twitter page at Word of Mouth Radio. Be sure to use the hashtag placenta. And if a friend has a good placenta story that you've heard, please pass that hashtag along to them. After all, we find the most vital stories get shared via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again tomorrow at 2 for more Word of Mouth, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.